This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Andrew Jackson had a reputation as a man of the people during his presidency, a man who helped expand the United States in the early 19th century. But of course, it did come at a terrible cost. Jackson's plans for expansion infamously included the forced relocation of American Indians, known now as the Trail of Tears. Thousands died during marches from the southeast to the plains. A lesser-known part of that history centers on Cherokee chief John Ross, who was doing all he could to peacefully assimilate his people. Ross had a long personal relationship and battle with Jackson. NPR's Steve Inskeep has written a book that tells the story from both perspectives. It's called Jackson Land, President Andrew Jackson, Cherokee Chief John Ross, and the Great American Land Grab. Steve Inskeep is the co-host of NPR's Morning Edition. He'll read from Jackson Land at Malaprop's bookstore in Asheville on Monday at 7 o'clock, but first joins me on the State of Things. Welcome, Steve. Good to talk with you.
Great to talk with you, Frank.
You're a man who wakes up very early in the morning and tells America all about what it needs to know. What led you to this story about Andrew Jackson and John Ross?
My day job, or as you point out, my early morning job, perhaps. Yeah, I cover politics and other events in the United States, and it's been a challenging time the last few years. A lot of things have happened that have been hard to understand, and that sort of drove me back into history, and I ended up finding this story that's really at the very beginning of the development of the democratic system as we know it in the 1820s and 30s.
All right, well, tell us about these two men. Well, let's start with the man we know most about, Andrew Jackson. By the way, a dispute over where he was born, was it Kitty Hawk or Ohio? I'm sorry, that's the right place.
But was it North Carolina or South Carolina? Right on the border, exactly, yeah. And there are different views of this, and I've heard different conclusions, and I just kind of avoid the whole thing in the book and say there was some dispute over whether the man was born, where the man was born, rather. Well, I'm pretty sure he was born in any case. Anyway, just an overwhelming, overpowering force of nature. You can describe him as a self-made man. He came from very humble beginnings and cut this giant swath through American life, and ultimately came to be known as the Frank Stacio of presidents, I think, is the way that it was. Yeah. No, wait a minute. That's not exactly right. I'm getting things a little tangled up here. No, but he was born in the Carolinas. His father died before he was born. His mother died when he was relatively young during the Revolutionary War. So he was an orphan as a young man and went off into the world, went west, and made his way as a lawyer, as a politician. We have to be Frank, also a slave owner, and became quite a wealthy man over time. He was also a militia general who became a war hero during the War of 1812, defeating both the British and, in what was substantively a more important victory, defeating Creek Indians, a victory that he leveraged to obtain something like 23 million acres of Creek land in Alabama and Georgia. And that is the essential beginning of the story that I try to tell. Jackson Land, the name I give to this book, is the name that I give to territory in the American South that Andrew Jackson obtained through wars, through treaties, and through a variety of other means over the course of more than 20 years.
It's a beautiful moment in American history to talk about this threshold where American ideals are beginning to catch hold, but of course American greed is now going to be responsible for what becomes known later as Manifest Destiny. And here he is, a guy right at the center of it, obtaining thousands and thousands of acres of land at the expense of the Indians, but also a guy who had great respect for Native Americans and, in fact, employed them to help him fight his battles, right?
Well, yeah, I appreciate you pointing that out. Jackson has been described as an Indian hater. That's fair in a way, but I think too simple. He was ruthless when someone stood in his way, whether they were Native American or African American or anything else, when his interest was at stake. When his financial interest was not at stake, he would allow some other instincts of fairness to emerge. And you're correct that he promised his Cherokee soldiers during the War of 1812 that they would receive the same pay and benefits as white soldiers. And when he found out after the war that the widows of some Cherokee soldiers were not receiving their proper death benefits, he wrote to Washington in protest. So he could see his way to fairness when his finances were not involved. But there's this word I've been thinking about a lot, interest. It's used a lot in the 19th century, and they specifically mean financial interest. And many people write in letters of that period as if to suggest that when it's just business, When your interest is at stake, it's understandable that you set your morals aside that might otherwise apply.
And then we have the story of John Ross, a man about whom we know much less, unless you read Steve's book, and then you'll know more. Tell us about John Ross.
John Ross I'd never heard of until 3 or 4 years ago, although I think if you're Cherokee or if you're from the Chattanooga area where he grew up and spent much of his life, you would know something more. He was a man of mixed race. He was the son and grandson of Scottish traders who'd come to trade among the Cherokees and the Appalachians, and also the son and grandson of Cherokee women who married those Scottish traders. He actually had more white blood than Cherokee blood. He was an English speaker, not so much a Cherokee speaker, but he became more and more attached to the Cherokee nation in the early 1800s as a young man, just at this moment when, as you said, the Cherokees were trying to accept and deal with this massive wave of white settlement and trying to assimilate into this new country, the United States. He turned out to be a perfect leader for that moment, for that time, because he could turn his face to the white community and speak in clear English and defiant English. He was a very tough negotiator. He was a stubborn man. He was a hard man to patronize or roll aside or shove aside, as many Indian leaders were. And he was also smart enough not to engage in a bloody rebellion, which would ultimately be hopeless because the Indians were so outnumbered by that point. He chose not to go to war, chose instead to fight within the emerging democratic system and to demand his rights within that system, which makes it, to me, Frank, a really modern story. I appreciated you saying it's a good moment to look at this because this is a moment when the United States is changing, when all different kinds of people are coming together in this country, and we're trying to figure out how to respect everyone's rights and still have one unified country. It's the same question that people faced then, and John Ross was in the middle of it.
Well, and as you point out in the book, and this is, I think, the point of assimilation, the Cherokee did embrace the ideals of the Enlightenment. They very much, in that moment, many Cherokee welcomed this new way of living and owned grist mills, became business owners, became slave owners. They certainly became part and parcel of the American fabric and embraced the principles of the Enlightenment, freedom, equality, etc., and used those regularly, as you point out in the book, to throw in the face of people like Jackson and say, I thought y'all were supposed to be fair. How come you're not doing that to us? I mean, it was a brilliant use of American ideals kind of thrown back in the face of the American government.
I agree entirely with that. We should stress that this was not unanimous among the Cherokee, and there have been brilliant scholars who've looked into this and done work that illuminated my work, that helped my work a great deal. There were some Cherokees who wanted to hold on to the old ways. There were many Cherokees, I think, who picked and chose between cultures and did what they felt was right and what was correct. In the end, the vast majority of Cherokees, however they stood culturally, stood behind John Ross politically. They had a historic homeland. It was in North Georgia and several surrounding states. It included a bit of North Carolina. And this was their land legally. It was their land by treaty with the United States. It was their land according to the United States Supreme Court in a famous ruling that John Ross instigated in 1832. It was their land, and they wanted to stay on it in spite of all the pressures to move west.
Talk about their relationship, Ross, because he did serve in the Cherokee Regiment in the War of 1812. Any indication that he and Jackson knew each other then?
I think it's likely that they would have at least seen each other because it was a small army. It was a few thousand men, and John Ross was not a common soldier. He was an officer. He was not a senior officer. He was an adjutant or assistant to a senior officer. So it is entirely plausible that they had some conversation at that time, and it is very likely that John Ross at least would have seen the commander of that army, Andrew Jackson, at some point. And they absolutely knew each other in later life. They met each other a number of times. They wrote a number of letters to each other. John Ross's letters to Jackson are more likely to have survived than Jackson's letters back, although there appear to have been some Jackson letters coming back. And they were, over the 20 years that followed the war, fighting not on the same side, they were in the same army, but against each other. They were antagonists in this battle over real estate. Within a few years after the end of the war, Andrew Jackson was involved in this gigantic scheme to capture the Tennessee River Valley, which apparently had been on his eye and the eye of other real estate speculators for many years. Jackson was a real estate speculator, among other things, and he succeeded in getting it surveyed and captured, in effect, by his side, by the United States. He was slapped down by John Ross. John Ross went over Jackson's head to his superiors in Washington and said, actually, this is legally Cherokee land. Jackson had to give it back. Jackson later found a different way to get the part of the real estate that he most wanted. But they were battling then, and they were battling later when Jackson became president and Ross became principal chief of the Cherokee Nation. There were sometimes face-to-face negotiations in the 1830s.
How did Jackson approach then this question of Indian removal? I mean, it becomes interesting. There are so many people, Americans then, with claims to vast tracts of land, specious and otherwise claims. Some of it might have been Indian territory. It is worthless land if you can't get people to settle there. And as long as there are natives there, that could be a problem. So Indian removal is in many ways tied up with the question of how much value do these land claims have as long as Native Americans are living on there. Isn't that right?
Yeah, and that's correct. And there's also just the question of the many different ways that you can look at the spread of white settlement across the United States. You can look at it as the expansion of the United States. And this is the way that Jackson would often write about it. This was the what we now call the Deep South, for the most part, and parts of the Mid-South. This was legally not really part of the United States. This was the territory of five independent Indian nations, although by the early 1800s they had accepted the broad protection of the federal government. They legally had their independence on their land, or a limited kind of independence on their land. Jackson viewed pushing them out of that land, getting them to cede land, as physically expanding the United States. So he saw it as a patriotic project. Also, he saw it as a national security project. He regarded Indians as potentially dangerous enemies, and they could also become allies of American antagonists and rivals like Spain and Britain, these colonial powers that still held great sway in parts of North America at that time. And he didn't want his potential enemies like the British to have allies right there in what is now Alabama, for example. So he wanted to push them out. National security motives, but also real estate motives. Jackson would shape his view of national security to fit perfectly his interest in real estate.
You spotlight some other figures that seem worthy of far more attention than they have gotten in American history. One of them, newspaper publisher Elias Boudinot, if I have his name pronounced right. Tell us about his newspaper, the Cherokee Phoenix.
This was one of the most fascinating parts of the story to me. And I'd heard a fragment of it. I'd heard that there was a Cherokee newspaper. I'd heard that it was done in the Cherokee language, which Sequoia had famously invented and introduced to the world just a few years before the publication began in 1828. So I'd heard that part of it, but I didn't know the other part, which was that in addition to being this powerful cultural tool for literacy, it was a powerful political tool, because when you go and look at the 1828 issues of the Cherokee Phoenix, and you can still find the actual issues in the Library of Congress here in Washington, you see an article in Cherokee, and you see the same article in the next column in English. The articles were also in English, and the paper, I discovered, was sent around the country to the editors of as many as 100 other newspapers, and the surviving records show that many of those newspapers would reprint the articles or comment upon the articles or respond to and denounce the articles. And so there was this conversation, a very slow-moving, I suppose, but it was almost as if Cherokee Phoenix articles were going viral in the modern sense and adding to the national debate. And you have a situation where an oppressed minority is able to speak through its own people and its own words and tell its own story rather than having that story translated through white observers who may be sympathetic or not, but certainly have their own blind spots and biases.
Telling their own stories in their own words, but using, again, the language of the Enlightenment and American ideals as the premise for fair treatment for Cherokee people.
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line is that the Cherokees were saying, not we reject white society, which many Indian nations were. I mean, if you go and read the story of Tecumseh, who was a contemporary of John Ross, you'd get a very different story here. But the Cherokees were saying, not saying we want out, they were saying we want in. you guys are here. We understand that you're here. We want to be part of that society. And we also want to maintain our rights within that society. John Ross appears to have aspired to make the Cherokee Nation at some point a territory or state of the United States, rather like the Arkansas Territory or the state of Alabama.
You write about a meeting between John Ross and Andrew Jackson in 1834. Rouse, at that point, is pleading for Jackson to reconsider the Indian Removal Act. Tell us about that meeting.
Yeah, it's a really sad moment, Frank. This is getting quite late in this more than 20-year battle. And yeah, a law has been passed which enables, it doesn't force precisely, but it enables Indians to be leveraged west of the Mississippi. And Ross has been refusing and refusing. He even won a Supreme Court judgment, which was essentially bypassed and ignored. He goes and he meets Andrew Jackson and later writes Andrew Jackson a letter, President Andrew Jackson, a letter saying, listen, I got a deal for you. How about if we give up part of our land, but not all of it? And how about if we also enter into an arrangement where we will be on the way to becoming citizens of the United States? So John Ross is raising the prospect that the Cherokee Nation will in some form cease to exist or cease to be quite the same as it was, quite as separate as it was, if he can only be allowed, his people can only be allowed to keep some of their real estate. And the answer from Andrew Jackson's administration was actually no. The thing we need you to do is for everybody to go. That is the only thing that will solve this problem. And to be fair to Jackson, he insisted it was the only thing that was going to save the Cherokees because it was a widely held opinion among many whites and Native Americans as well that they were being destroyed by their contact with white society, that there was a corrosive effect from white land grabbers and white culture and white sold alcohol, and that it would be better for Indians to get out west where they could be by themselves.
All right. Well, I have to ask you this question, Steve, because, you know, you created a little stir there at the mothership being NPR. When you featured the book on your own program, Morning Edition, you talked about it. Last week, NPR's ombudsman criticized the decision, called it a conflict of interest, and NPR has since changed its policy. I do want to ask you about that decision, your decision to promote your book on your show. What do you think?
Okay, well, let's just get into the exact words you used there, Frank. It wasn't my decision. My colleagues made the decision, as they make other editorial decisions about Morning Edition, and they certainly do know me. But they know me and make judgments about all my other stories that I do. In my view, this was a story that I reported, that I learned, that was relevant to the work that I do, to the historical interviews that I do, to the modern political interviews that I do. And I talked about that story on Morning Edition. And that, to me, is about the same.
Yep. Well, I raised the question because it is in the news. People know about it. People know about you. And, of course, the same can be asked of us as a radio station. After all, we're part of one big system. I do know you personally. We're acquaintances. We're colleagues. So why would they have them on the state of things? And
well,
it is pretty much the same answer. I mean, it is pretty
is
much
good,
the same answer.
Yeah. I appreciate that, Frank. And this is a good standard for anybody to apply. The good thing about my work is that it's public. Anything that I do is out there. The book is out there. Any interviews that I do are out there. Any stories that I do, by their very nature, they're public. And people can look at them and judge, was this worth the time or not? Was this a valid use of time or not? Was this something that I learned from or not? And that, to me, is the fundamental question. In this case, I'm gratified that this book has also been covered by the PBS NewsHour, has been covered by the BBC, has been covered by the New York Times, the Washington Post, and a number of major metropolitan dailies. So I think that my colleague's choice was essentially that we had this story, and it was by somebody from NPR. And so they put it on the program where I normally put my stories.
Steve, always a pleasure. So good to talk with you. Thank you so much.
It's an honor to do it, Frank. Thanks very much.
Steve Inskeep is the co-host of NPR's Morning Edition. The new book is called Jackson Land, President Andrew Jackson, Cherokee Chief John Ross, and the Great American Land Grab. Steve is going to be reading at Malaprop's bookstore in Asheville on Monday at 7 o'clock. We have details at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, novelist Allison Liotta takes us into the fictional courtroom of a sex crimes prosecutor, and we will have that conversation in a moment on The State of Things.